Hi, welcome to the On Science podcast. I'm NPR science editor Alison Richards. This week, we hear about ash, clouds of ash, from an Icelandic volcano that kept European airspace closed for days.
You can see this giant plume. It's just amazing. I mean, right now it looks a little bit like dark cauliflower, I would say.
We'll hear more from Joe Palka. And ash isn't the only stuff that causes problems in the air. So does pollen.
So you're wearing a mask there?
I'm using it for the allergies. If I don't get plugged up, they start running and my voice. Right now, it's not my voice.
And if you think your nose has started running sooner this year, you might be right. As you'll hear in a minute, in some places, spring has come early. But first, keeping our brains in shape. Body or brain? Use it or lose it. Well, that's what we're led to believe, especially as we grow older. It sounds such a good idea. Give your brain a complete workout in just minutes a day. That sort of advertisement has sold millions of computer games and other programs to people trying to keep their brains sharp. But do mental gymnastics really make a difference? John Hamilton reports on a huge study designed to find out.
The authors of the study are prominent researchers in the UK, people like Jessica Gran of the Medical Research Council's Cognition and Brain Sciences Unit. But Gran says the idea came from a BBC television program.
The BBC were interested to see if the claims made by commercial brain trainers that training your brain, you know, improves general cognitive function and gives you more brain power are true. So they actually approached us and said, would you help us develop, you know, a scientific way of testing this?
What they came up with was a brain training website open to pretty much anyone. More than 11,000 people between 18 and 60 signed up. All of them got standard tests like those used to measure memory and IQ. Then people were randomly assigned to one of three groups. The first would play games like those used in commercial brain training programs. A second would do brain exercises designed by the researchers, and a third would surf the web. Gran says people in the brain training groups had to spend 10 minutes three times a week doing things like pretending to be an airport security worker watching an X-ray scanner.
Bags are going in and coming out, but they're not going in and coming out at exactly the same rate. So occasionally the conveyor belt stops and they have to say how many bags are actually left in the X-ray scanner.
After 6 weeks, Gran says, people had become really good at things like remembering how many bags are in a scanner.
Pretty much every single test that people trained on, they got better on.
That was the good news.
When we then looked at how they performed on tests that weren't the exact test that they had performed on, even when they were quite similar, there was no difference between the group that had been surfing the internet for 6 weeks and the groups that had been brain training.
Their overall mental skills hadn't changed. Matthew Shapiro, a memory researcher at Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York, says he's not surprised.
You shouldn't expect that playing with the computer and doing computerized testing is going to produce an overnight magical transformation of your abilities so that if you've been forgetful for the last 2 years, that suddenly you'll be able to remember everything.
But Shapiro says the negative result may have been because people really didn't invest that much effort in training their brains.
I don't think any students who have to do well on a difficult exam could get by studying 10 minutes at a time every other day.
Shapiro says more intensive training might produce a different result. Elizabeth Zielinski from the University of Southern California once advised Nintendo on its brain training game. She says companies generally avoid making any claims that their product will raise your IQ. But she says that hasn't changed people's expectations.
People who are doing this training, they want to get smarter. They want to remember better.
Zielinski says there's no sure way to do that. So she says people who want to improve their minds should pick something really challenging and rewarding.
Personally, I'm learning how to play the piano. And I don't think learning how to play the piano is going to make me a better statistician. But it's one of these things that's enjoyable, it's interesting. I don't know if it's going to have any effect on my, you know, whether I get dementia or not, you know, in 30 years.
But Zielinski says at least she'll know how to play the piano. The new study was published online by the journal Nature. John Hamilton, NPR News.
The eruption of the volcano in Iceland has got governments, airlines and scientists around the globe thinking about planes, airspace and the dangers of volcanic ash. NPR's Joe Palka headed to Iceland shortly after the eruption began. He described the scene to Guy Raz.
What I'm seeing in front of me, what I see, is a glacier, a white glacier on the side of this volcano, and then at the top of the glacier, you can see this giant plume. There's two levels to this plume. One is a whitish plume, which is the water vapor that's going into the air, and the other is much, much darker, and that's the ash that is causing all the trouble for air travel. The ash contains various noxious things in it. One of the worst is these silicates, which is like glass, which can gum up aircraft engines.
What are scientists saying about how long this eruption will continue?
Guy, let me characterize what scientists are saying. Not much. What they're basically saying is they don't know. They're prepared for it to last anywhere from another 15 minutes to several weeks or a couple of years.
2 days later, Joe joined a group of Icelandic volcanologists who'd been out gathering data on the eruption.
Shortly before noon today, people started wandering into the third floor coffee room in the building housing the Nordic Volcanology Center on the campus of the University of Iceland. The occasion was a chance for the center staff to hear the latest news from the volcano. Shortly after noon, a harried young scientist came running into the room with a laptop computer. Bjorn Odson had just come in from the airport next to the university. He'd spent the morning flying over the volcano.
I haven't looked at this data, so I'm looking at it first time, like you. So if you see something interesting, then we just stop and look at it.
Odson projected a variety of images he had just collected. While it was clear the volcano was still erupting, it was equally clear that the eruption was smaller than it had been last week. There was some speculation that the hot magma coming from the interior of the Earth was now emerging from the volcano as lava, but Odson's pictures show that's not the case.
No lava flowing around there. It's all fragmented.
Next, Sigrun Reinsdottir presented data from her ground stations that measure how the Earth is moving around the volcano. Before the eruption, the Earth ballooned out with magma that was ready to erupt. Now the balloon appears to be deflating.
Complicated story, but the main thing here is that we are seeing deflation of the volcano. We are not seeing inflation. And that's a good thing.
And then Joe got up close and personal, with the volcano, that is. He went ash collecting with two geochemists.
The drive from Reykjavik to the foot of the erupting volcano takes about 2 hours. Volcanologist Evgenia Ilinskaya and Ausa Sigurdardóttir are geochemists. Both are Icelandic by birth. Evgenia is now at the University of Cambridge in England, and Ausa is working at the University of Iceland. It's a gorgeous day, a brilliant blue sky with a few wispy clouds. But ahead of us, a giant plume of smoke rises from the volcano. As we get closer, the darker part of the plume hangs like a giant gray curtain across the road. We enter the plume, and the sky turns dark. The car is enveloped in thick gray haze.
I think I'll just look for somewhere to... Yeah, take the car off the road in case somebody comes, because they won't be able to see the car from anywhere.
We all put on gas masks, and Evgenia and Ausa head outside to set up a gas analyzer and to collect some dust. I try to go outside, but the strong blowing wind makes it impossible to record any sound, so I retreat to the car.
So it's wild because a few seconds ago, it was so dark in here that you couldn't see anything, and now it's lightened up a bit. And now it's dark again. Ausa and Evgenia are outside collecting more dust.
The reason for doing all this is that the ash contains important information about what makes a volcano tick. The gases say what kind of material the hot magma has been passing through as it rises from deep in the earth. And the ash can tell things about the nature of the eruption. But the answers will only come when the material gets analyzed back in the lab.
It needs to be analysed in several different stages almost. First, you would wash it with water to see what comes off it.
Then you wash it in acids to see what else comes off, and then you look at it under the microscope. Its size and shape tells you about the temperatures and pressures that existed when the ash was created. Evgenia says this kind of data is important for understanding volcanoes in general.
Probably immediately it's more pressing to understand this particular volcano because it is still erupting.
And that's something the world has taken a great deal of interest in lately. Joe Palka, NPR News, Reykjavik.
Back home, most of us worry more about that mundane form of air pollution, spring pollen. The city of Albuquerque has been trying to help people with allergies by reducing the amount of tree pollen. Since 1994, the city has barred residents from planting certain trees, like mulberries, elms and cottonwoods. NPR's Jeff Brady went to Albuquerque to find out if their program is working.
Albuquerque doesn't have as many trees as most towns, but when you combine the ones it does have with hot, dry, and often windy weather, that can create big problems for allergy sufferers. 16 years back, the city council added a pollen control ordinance to the books. It bans entire categories of trees and threatens a $500 fine for violators. If you want to find out whether the ordinance is doing any good, Dan Gates is your guy. He works for the city's air quality division. Most mornings, Gates treks up some metal stairs and heads toward a green, sun-faded machine at an air monitoring station.
So what we'll do here is we'll pull this slide out. I put that in my sample box, and I just replace it with the new slide.
Later, Gates will look through a microscope and tally up individual grains on that slide. That's how he determines the pollen count for the day. So here's the big question. After 16 years of banning trees that make allergy sufferers miserable, does Gates see evidence that pollen counts are declining?
I haven't seen anything in the numbers.
Gates says the counts aren't rising, but they don't appear to be going down either. That's disappointing news for residents like Malachi Romero. I caught up with him as he was finishing a bike ride along the Rio Grande River.
So you're wearing a mask there?
Yes, I am, yeah. I'm using it for the allergies. They get real bad. If I don't get plugged up, they start running, and my throat changes my voice. Right now, it's not my voice.
And it's not just the cottonwoods by the river. Romero has to worry about what's growing in his own yard.
The two trees that are at my house are outlaw trees. Those were planted before that law passed.
And that's the main reason pollen counts aren't down, says city forester Nick Kuhn. While the 1994 ordinance barred residents from planting new trees, it grandfathered in the old ones.
We have to wait for those trees to grow to their mature age and die for whatever reason or be cut down because of development. We have to wait for them to be gone.
Kuhn says as Albuquerque grew, city fathers encouraged people to plant trees, like the Siberian elm. It looks like the elms most of us know, but a little smaller. It survives the hot summers and lack of water in Albuquerque because it's tough.
There's a reason why they're tough, and it's because they've evolved over years to be able to reproduce themselves well, and that means pollen.
These days, Kuhn spends a lot of time educating Albuquerque residents and local nurseries about what trees are allowed. Some of his advice is good for allergy sufferers everywhere. For example, he says if you want to avoid hay fever-inducing trees in your yard, look for flowering trees.
If you see it's got pretty flowers, that's a good tree to have because they're evolved to use insects, not wind. So they're safe. They're not the allergenic species.
And Kuhn says you're always safe with female or sterile trees because they don't release any pollen. Jeff Brady, NPR News.
Scientists who study the world's climate have been predicting that global warming could make spring start sooner. And that appears to be what is happening, at least in some places. To find them, as NPR's Christopher Joyce reports, you can just follow your nose.
If you're like me, spring arrives the day I wake up with a head like a balloon and a nose that's running faster than Usain Bolt. Spring means pollen, and an early spring means...
Our noses start running earlier in the spring than they used to.
That's Dave Schimmel, a scientist who runs the National Ecological Observation Network, or NEON. Now, noses aren't exactly scientific instruments. All sorts of things can make them run. So scientists look for other markers of spring. Schimmel looks for them in the Rocky Mountains.
One of the most reliable ones is the timing of snowmelt. Looking back over those records retrospectively, one can see a very steady, progressive change towards earlier snowmelt and earlier runoff.
There are other signs, too. Lilacs or dogwoods are flowering earlier in many places, for example. Scientists who study how seasons affect plant and animal life cycles, it's called phenology, say on average spring is coming several days earlier now than it did a few decades ago, something climate scientists say is a sign of a warming world. And Schimmel says early spring has consequences. For example, if snow melts earlier, the vegetation will suck up the water right away.
And the system dries out, which leaves a much longer dry spell for the rest of the summer, and fairly dramatically increases the possibilities of wildfire.
The environmental group Union of Concerned Scientists is collecting data on early spring. Among those who are producing the data is Jake Weltzen, an ecologist at the U.S. Geological Survey. He points out that early spring may confuse plants and insects and make them shift their schedules with unhappy results.
So that a bee that's coming along and gathering pollen from plants might end up where there is no pollen available because some of the plants have shifted earlier and others haven't shifted at all.
To get a look at what early spring looks like on the ground, I visited Dennis Wiggum, a botanist at the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center in Maryland. Wiggum spends much of his time in the center's hardwood deciduous forest. He says many plants and trees, spring beauty, spicebush, oaks, and maples, are emerging or flowering earlier than usual because of higher temperatures.
If you look at one year compared to the next, you might not see that pattern because some years are cooler in the spring than the previous year, but in general, it's clearly becoming warmer sooner.
Many plants remain dormant until soil and air temperatures get warm enough for a certain number of days. Then they take off. Wiggum finds one of spring's debutantes near a stream.
This is an understory herb. This particular one is called bloodroot. It's the first understory herb to appear in the spring, and so it has these lovely white flowers.
It's only a few inches tall with tiny white flowerlets, but this year it's behaved strangely. Normally, it flowers for 2 weeks, but like many plants this year in Wiggum's forest, its life cycle has sped up.
I noticed this year the flowers are, I was seeing them for only about a week, which again is this whole notion of everything being compressed because it was so warm.
Wiggum says he doesn't know whether this hurried flowering is due to climate change or something else, but scientists say a warming climate may lead plants and animals to do some strange things. And they may have to do some very strange things to survive where they are if springtimes continue to come earlier and temperatures keep rising. Either that or hit the road and head north. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
And that's all from On Science. If you'd like to hear more or read more, you can visit our website, npr.org/science. We'll be back next week. Thanks for listening. I'm Alison Richards.